will call the docket.
Case JG 231 against Council et al. By Blake Gladstone, J. Matthew, J. Jr., D. Thomas, Jared, E. Walton, C. Pelley.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Gladstone, counsel for KJG. We're here to ask the court to reverse the trial court and enter final judgment for KJG on the two verdicts which the trial court set aside, the first being for fraud and the inducement against Mr. Haley in the amount of $110,000, and the second against Mr. Haley, we contend, for punitive damages arising from the underlying case for $220,000. We believe that the trial court erred in setting aside both verdicts because in neither instance did the trial court express or elaborate its ruling in terms of the applicable law, which is that the evidence was insufficient or that the verdict was plainly wrong. Also, as to the punitive damage verdict, the trial court applied the wrong standard. Importantly, neither the trial court nor Mr. Haley have argued that there was insufficient evidence in this case for these verdicts. We believe that the setting aside of the verdicts is an abuse of discretion because...
Counsel, may I interrupt you for a moment? Am I right that count three of the complaint was the only count directed in fraud against Haley?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Am I also right in reading this, particularly paragraph 41 and 44, that this is a pretty well-drafted attempt to pierce the corporate veil as opposed to an attempt to make a direct non-derivative claim?
I would submit that the count accomplishes both, Your Honor, with the language at the end of the count.
Well, help me out with that, because 41 says Haley controlled Halco as an alter ego, alias, stooge, dummy. 44 says that these facts in this count warrant the penetration of limited liability business form to impose liability on Haley individually. And then, as a result, the count seeks remedy. If I were reading this count as a defense attorney, I would not see it as anything other than piercing the corporate veil count.
Well, Your Honor, honestly, I haven't memorized the language exactly. It hasn't been raised in this litigation. That wasn't raised.
That was the basis of the trial court's belief that the verdict was logically inconsistent.
I would submit, Your Honor, that the issue of the content and what was sought was never raised as an objection to the instructions that were given. And furthermore, I would submit that the count, that there is language in it that captures, there's broader language at the end of the count that of the paragraph that actually captures that. It's true, Your Honor, that there was a piercing the corporate veil theory that would capture Mr. Haley if there were verdicts against Halco and Haley Builders. However, there was catch-all language in there that captured that, and I would submit that had that not been the case, we would have had an appeal. That would have been an issue on the instructions at trial, and it would have been a cross-appeal basis in this court here, in this instance.
Counsel, do you believe that in Virginia, a stranger to a contract can be liable for fraudulently inducing a party to enter into it?
In this instance, we believe that they could, and we put the evidence on for that purpose.
Okay, and what Virginia cases do you rely upon for that doctrine?
We did not. We didn't brief that in this instance because it was not raised. It was raised neither in the trial court nor on appeal, Your Honor.
But your theory is that you are piercing the corporate veil to get at Mr. Haley.
Yes, that was one of the theories,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Okay. And if you are unsuccessful in piercing the corporate veil, then how do you get at Mr. Haley individually?
Because of his freestanding independent fraud in inducing entry into the contract.
But he wasn't a party to the contract.
I understand that, but okay. he was also stood to benefit directly from the contract.
Understood.
And we put evidence
on
that.
So you are indeed, in this litigation, relying upon a theory that a stranger to a contract can be liable for fraudulently inducing a party to enter into it.
In this instance, that was...
And what Virginia authority do you rely upon for that doctrine?
I do not have that with me today, Your Honor, because it was not challenged and we did not brief it.
Are you familiar with our case of Station Number 2 versus Lynch from 2010?
No, sir.
Okay. In that case, we very specifically declined to reach the issue because no Virginia Supreme Court has never reached that issue. And your theory of liability is one that, as far as I know, has no basis whatsoever in common law.
Your Honor, under the circumstances, under the Wintergreen case, that was never challenged as such in the trial court. It was never raised in the trial court.
Well, I'm raising it now.
Well, I understand.
And I want your answer.
And
perhaps it's just for my own edification. I understand the procedural posture.
Yes, sir. I understand, and the answer that I can give to you is that it wasn't addressed directly because it was never raised.
Okay.
And to answer your question directly once again.
But you drafted the pleading.
Yes.
Your theory was that you, in fact, could reach an individual in his individual capacity, not in terms of piercing the corporate veil, to
yes.
find him liable for inducing somebody else to enter into a contract.
Because of the self-benefit involved,
mm-hmm.
yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because that was the crux of the problem, whether it went through one of the other corporations or whether it dealt with him individually.
Okay.
At this stage, we believe that there's no basis for the trial court's irreconcilable inconsistency argument, which is, of course, what the trial court relied upon in setting aside the fraud verdict. No instruction required a verdict of fraud against Halco and piercing of the corporate veil against Halco before a fraud finding against Haley could occur. The piercing the corporate veil liability path addresses a separate issue, as we've just discussed, from Haley's own personal fraud in the matter. Under the instructions, while piercing the corporate veil is a necessary verdict to hold Haley liable for a verdict found against Halco, piercing the veil is irrelevant to a fraud verdict against Haley individually. We believe that's the correct logic of the instructions. Indeed, the alleged inconsistency exists only if a requirement not contained in the instructions, that is, fraud against Halco and piercing the corporate veil, and that is, as a predicate to the fraud verdict against Haley, read into the instructions, and a liability path, that is, individual liability of Haley, which is contained in the instructions, is read out of the instructions.
May I interrupt you one more time?
Yes, certainly.
I think I'm understanding better what you're saying to us. But suppose it's true that you sort of assumed all through the litigation that despite the language of the count, there was an existing allegation directly against a non-party, Mr. Haley, and that you could prove fraud and recover. Just assume that's what you believed, and you say you believe that now. The trial judge probably didn't believe that. And the trial judge got the motion to set aside and said, well, it doesn't work that way. It's never worked that way. No one argued that to me. I don't remember getting a jury instruction that specifically distinguished piercing corporate veil fraud versus direct liability fraud. So I don't know exactly what the jury was thinking, but I need to retry the case and sort this out. Now, putting aside for a second, you know, literally what the law says or doesn't say on a subject, isn't that a pretty proper use of judgment when there's substantial doubt as to what the jury actually did in its verdict?
Well, I would submit that as to the fraud verdict, there was no substantial doubt because the verdict was expressly for fraud against Mr. Haley. There's been no argument of insufficient evidence on that. And no cross appeal on as to the absence of a right to bring that action.
But the piercing instruction would have led a jury to believe, and would have led a trial judge to believe that was the whole point of it.
But that wasn't the only instruction given, Justice. The other instruction, there was a freestanding fraud instruction given, and the instructions expressly authorized the finding of individual fraud against Mr. Haley. And it's our position simply that under that Wintergreen case that's the case. I would like, if I may, to move on to the punitive damage aspect of the case, if I may, so at least I may say a few words about that. 10 factors we believe support more than just a reasonable inference that the punitive damage verdict was intended by the jury to be against Haley individually. First of all, there were only 2 candidates for punitive damages, and I would note that these do not rest on the fraud finding necessarily.
Is that true that there were only two candidates? Instruction number 31, if I'm reading it correctly, would allow punitives against all three.
I understand that, Your Honor, but as a practical matter, the court had already found that the only candidates for punitive damages were Haley and Halko.
And I recognize that, but was the jury so instructed?
The court is exactly right. We did not address that and do not address it now because under the Cape Charles reasonable inference analysis, it would be unreasonable for a jury to have returned a verdict against Haley Builders when there was admittedly, as the trial court indicated in its judgment order, there was no evidence entered against them. So under the reasonable inference and reasonable inquiry standard under Cape Charles, that's not an option that would be a reasonable one for a court in the position the court was in analyzing the punitive damage verdict to address it. And certainly we know that in any event, that finding instruction the court just addressed is inconsistent with the issues instruction that was correct.
It is, and so it's inconsistent with the issues instruction. It allows the jury to award punitives to either of these three entities, or the two entities and the individual, and the punitive damages instruction itself, if I'm not reading it incorrectly, does not limit it to the fraud count. So what's the jury to make of that, not knowing what you all knew was what the court had said punitives couldn't run against Haley Builders?
Well, I think, as I said, that the answer is that under that a court in the position that the court was in, having received a verdict form that had not any of the checks checked off, that the court was in a position of attempting, or ought to have, which it did not do, apply the Cape Charles reasonable inference analysis, and it would have ruled out Haley Builders as a punitive damage option at that point, simply because, as the court itself had ruled earlier, there was no evidence presented against Haley Builders on that point. So in terms of discerning under Cape Charles, the reasonable inference as to the intent of the jury on punitive damages, the Haley Builders would have been a non-issue simply because of the absence of evidence.
Counsel, can I ask you a question?
Yes,
shouldn't
please.
The court have sent this back, sent the jury back and told them to fill out the rest of the form?
I'm sorry, pardon?
Shouldn't the court have sent it back to the jury and asked them to fill out the rest of the form?
They probably ought to, and at that point, had we been alerted to that, the verdict form, the omission in the verdict form probably would have been addressed and corrected. But the dilemma is that what happened at trial, and it's in the record, and it's reflected in the record, is that the jury verdict was read, and the jury was immediately dismissed before certainly counsel recognized that there was a problem, that is, unchecked boxes on the form, on the verdict form. And we didn't learn about it until later. Indeed, it wasn't. That issue only came about after the jury was gone.
Well, let me ask you this. If we don't agree with you here today, is this a mistrial? Does it go back again?
That's a great question, Your Honor, because
all of our questions are great questions.
Especially. Seniority on them, so.
I apologize. I don't mean to speak lightly to you, Your Honor.
We're speaking lightly to you.
That was a real dilemma, and I think that dilemma as to what to do in this case, given the fact that there were already verdicts absolving Halko of fraud and finding Haley responsible for fraud, I think the court did not know what to do and eventually just concluded to enter judgment for Halko and Haley on punitive damages, even though on the verdict form, the jury had expressly rejected absolving Haley and Halko from punitive damages on the verdict form. Indeed, that gets, of course, again to the heart of the problem that one of the problems that we point out on the punitive damage issue, and that is that the court took the position that I'm not going to enter punitive damages, I'm going to set it aside because I don't know what the jury intended. And under Cape Charles, the court at that point ought to have applied the reasonable inference standard announced in Cape Charles and analyzed the case, the evidence, the other verdicts, and reached a conclusion and analyzed it in that way. And as we have argued in our brief...
Can I interrupt you again? Can I interrupt you again? The actual motion to set aside was a motion for, to set aside and award a new trial, the defense motion was. And the court eventually went further than that.
It did.
Are you suggesting, in response to the last question, that implicit in your argument is that if you lose on the merits, the remedy is still a new trial? The remedy is not a JNOV?
At this stage, after thinking it through, Your Honor, no, we don't. We believe that the only remedy, based on the final order that was entered, would be this court to reverse and enter final judgment. I'm out of time.
I have one additional question. You started to say that punitive damages could rise or fall independent of our determination on fraud. If we affirm on count one, do you believe we can still reach, or if we affirm on assignment of error one, do you believe we can still reach assignment of error two?
If you affirm on one, yes, I do believe that, because it was from a different piece of the case, and that would only remove from a factual standpoint a couple of the points that we raised that support a reasonable inference that the verdict was intended for Haley.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've used my time.
Yes, and a little more. But that wasn't your fault.
Hey, it pleases the court. I am Derek Rosser, and I'm here representing Halco LLC and Gregory W. Haley. There are two assignments of error before the court. One deals with the trial court's decision to set aside the jury's verdict awarding $220,000 in punitive damages. In this case, as the court is aware, the jury failed to identify the party against whom it was awarding the punitive damages. And the jury was discharged before it was given an opportunity to correct that omission. This court has held that the trial court does not have the authority to amend a verdict of a jury as to a matter of substance after the jury has been discharged and the trial has terminated. And in fact, there are cases where juries have been discharged, have gone back to the jury room, perhaps to get their fee, and been called back to the court because there's an error in the verdict form, and this court has held that in those cases, once the jury is discharged and left the presence of the court, they do not have the authority to alter or amend their own verdict.
But why wasn't the right response, instead of a JNOV, a motion for a new trial being granted, verdict vacated, mistrial declared, and retrial? I don't understand that.
It was our position, Your Honor, that you could not identify who, and this issue about the box not being checked, if you will, to identify who the party was against whom the damages were being awarded, was not brought to our attention until after the fact. So it wasn't like the judge discharged the jury that evening and said, oh my goodness, this is a mistake. It was brought to our attention afterwards. And so when we looked at it, our motion was, well, there's no judgment awarded as to anyone as to punitive damages. And so to the extent that there is a verdict awarding punitive damages to the plaintiff, it should be set aside. Now, at that point in time...
I don't understand that. You said there's no verdict award to anyone as to punitive damages. When I see a sheet that says $220,000 was awarded in punitive damage.
I misspoke. Oh. It didn't identify, my apologies, it did not identify the party against whom the damages were being awarded. And so at that point in time, the court obviously couldn't call the jury back and amend, seek to have it correct form. So it was our position that since the verdict did not make a determination as to whom against whom the award was being made, that it should be set aside. Quite frankly, we didn't want a new trial. We just wanted it set aside. That's why we asked for what we asked for.
Right, but I mean, your motion is, wherefore the defendants respectfully request the court enter an order setting aside the verdict, which is what you do when you do a mistrial, and awarding a new trial. So, I mean, I thought that was perfectly consistent with the procedure, and it was a good motion. I'm not criticizing you at all, but the trial judge went further than that. an entered JNOV. That's the part, but the appellant has just waived that in open court. I just don't understand it. I was hoping you would be able to explain it to me.
Your Honor, I wish I could. I can't tell you. Honestly, at the time that we filed the motion and then we argued it, the motion was filed, I think, in July, and we went back and forth. It was argued in September, and as the court is aware, a final judgment in January, and somewhere along the line, that decision was made differently than perhaps was first presented to the court. The other issue, though, and I would like to point out, the appellant has taken the position that the Cape Charles analysis should have been applied by the trial court, that there was sufficient evidence from which the trial court could make a reasonable determination of what the jury intended. The problem with that, one is, it's our position that the failure to identify the party is a substantial omission, and that you can't make that determination. But the other issue, and the appellant points out in the brief, due to a Scrivener's error, the verdict form did not have an option to award punitive damages against Mr. Haley only. And as the court is aware, the jury instructions and the verdict form, if they are unobjected to and presented to the jury, become the law of the case. And so the jury did not have the option to do what the appellant is asking you to do. And I would respectfully submit that is the jury made, obviously they didn't make a decision, but the decision that the appellant would have you make, the jury didn't have the option to make.
Do you think one of the reasons why the jury didn't check one of the blocks is because the option that they wanted to pick wasn't up there?
I don't know what they wanted, Your Honor. I'll be honest with you, because a couple of things. One thing that's not before this court, the jury awarded damages of $90,000 against Haley Builders on a breach of contract claim. That verdict was reduced because the evidence didn't support that. And that's not on appeal, because that wasn't challenged on appeal. As Justice Powell pointed out, and I heard Justice Lemons talk about excellence and trying to be, the professional. And one of the things that seems to happen in trials is the next day you have a better argument. The next day you have better jury instructions. One of the jury instructions, as has been pointed out, would permit the jury to award punitive damages against Halco, Haley, and Haley Builders. But the verdict form does not allow a judgment against Haley or Haley Builders. So I would submit to the court, we don't know what the jury intended. And we can argue and we can point to this factor or that factor, but that would require us to engage in speculation.
But the irony is, if the trial judge had anything to do with this, I don't know, but the irony is the verdict form does conform to the logic of Pearson, which is you can find the corporation and hit them with fraud and the inducement. You can pierce the corporate veil and find the corporation and hit them with fraud and also Haley. But you can't find Haley and not the corporation. I mean, that's the way the verdict form, those are the options, which is consistent with the legal theory of the case.
Well, and which brings us, I think, to the first assignment of error, and the question is whether the trial court erred in setting aside the verdict awarding $110,000 in favor of KJG on a claim of fraudulent inducement against Mr. Haley individually. As the court is aware, there were claims of fraud in the inducement asserted against Halco, against Haley individually, and then there was the piercing corporate veil. And what the jury was instructed was, in order to, the jury was asked to consider, among other things, whether Mr. Haley controlled or used Halco to perpetrate a fraud, commit an injustice, or to gain an unfair advantage over KJG 231. That was Instruction 11, and Instruction 35 instructed the jury that in order to disregard the separate legal existence of either a limited liability corporation company or corporation, KJG, must show that Halco was the alter ego, alias, stooge, or dummy of Mr. Haley, and that Halco was a device or sham used to disguise wrongs, obscure fraud, conceal crime, or they personal obligations.
Was there ever an instruction that said you can find against Haley despite the fact he's not a party to the contract if you find 1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Not that way. Not an instruction that was put that way. And
but wouldn't 11, talking about instructions being the law of the case, it seems to me that you have a problem with instruction number 11 with paragraphs 3 and 4. If the only argument is piercing the corporate veil, then you don't need paragraph 3, because paragraph 4 is the if you find Haley controlled the corporations and committed the fraud. 3 seems to allow this jury to find fraud against Haley in his individual capacity. Whether that's possible under... but that seems to be the problem with your jury instruction number 11.
I would agree that under that instruction, they're asked, that's identified as an issue for them to consider. And I think the court is right that we are, those were the instructions that were given to the jury. However, inartfully, they may have been drafted in certain instances, and that becomes the law of the case. The question, I think, before the court, though, is when you consider the various theories that the court had, the jury had to consider, what you see is they made decisions that seemed to be inconsistent and irreconcilable, and that's what the judge found. I mean, she, after the jury was discharged, she made that comment from the bench. They're totally inconsistent. On the one hand, they find that he is liable for fraud in the inducement, and then on the other hand, they don't hold him responsible for piercing the corporate veil for the same conduct. And when we filed our motion, we argued the motion, that was the basis upon which she decided that it should be set aside. And it is our position, Your Honor, that her finding in the circumstances of this case is not an abuse of discretion. That she made the determination that this inconsistency that's so irreconcilable it makes it plainly wrong for them to award the damages that they awarded on the fraud and the inducement case, and as such, her decision, I believe, should be affirmed.
And well, it would be 33 and 35 were finding instructions, right, on Pearson. 11 is not a finding instruction.
It's an issues instruction.
Yeah, it's not even a theory of the case instruction. It's an issues instruction. So I'm wondering if you're reading these holistically and you get to like 33 and it says in order to disregard, or 35, in order to disregard the separate corporate existence. You know, all I'm getting to is I'm not seeing a finding instruction on personal fraud liability independent and unrelated to piercing. And obviously, I, as you've heard earlier, I don't see it being pled.
I'm not sure that there was a...
Well, let me ask you about Instruction 18. Isn't Instruction 18 a finding instruction that talks about fraud? Personally by Haley?
Yeah.
To be honest, I don't have that instruction with me, so I can't answer that question.
I could read it to you, but take up all your time. It seems to say that. It seems to be a finding instruction that says... Halco and or Gregory Haley, then it lists the elements of fraud and inducement.
Okay.
Mr. Grosser, your opposing counsel is volunteering to let you have his copy of the appendix.
That would, I believe, be the finding of yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, you heard opposing counsel's response to my questions, that he drafted the complaint intending to allege that Mr. Haley would be liable if he pierced the corporate veil, or independently as a stranger to the contract if he was unable to pierce the corporate veil. Did he argue those twin theories to the jury in this case?
Your Honor, I cannot recall specifically how he argued that.
There's not a jury instruction that clearly says that. It gives the alternative.
I would agree with that position, but I don't want to misstate what happened at trial.
Okay.
In this case, the appellants are asking the court to overturn the decision of the trial court and enter final judgment. They're not asking for a new trial. It's our position that the trial court, did not abuse its discretion in either ruling, and that its ruling should be affirmed.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And your time has expired. Call the next case.